Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Great Unknown, a novel, by Peg Kingman, read by Henrietta Meir. Prologue. Stevenson paused for a moment to catch his breath and ease his pounding heart, for these immense iron hoisting tongs were unwieldy and very heavy. He was working by moonlight beside a grike, a chasm in the limestone, at the north end of a little offshore island, Coquet Isle. The light dimmed suddenly, briefly, as clouds blew across the moon's face, then brightened again. The nearest man-made lights were at the southern tip of Coquet Isle, atop the lighthouse, and the next nearest lights after that were in the town 3/4 of a mile to the west, Amble on the Northumberland shore. As he desired above all to avoid the notice of the townspeople, he worked by moonlight. He was sweat-drenched, despite the hard wind that came scouring across 500 miles of North Sea. Why must everything worth doing be so exceedingly difficult and slow? He had hauled these hoisting tongs, hinged like colossal scissors, all the way from Paris. Likewise, his winch, chains, cables, blocks, tackles. He had hauled even this mast and beam from France, lashed to the deck of a lugger out of Rouen. He had brought all these, not because they couldn't be had here, along this English coast, for they could, but they couldn't be had here secretly, privately, and without attracting notice. Having chosen a convenient stone ledge, well down inside the grike, so that nothing should be silhouetted against the sky, he resumed his task. The setting up of a crane was so familiar to him that he could do it alone, in silence, at night. 1. The new wet nurse's uncovered breast was mottled blue and red under taut, translucent skin. The nipple was small, neat, and pink. It was a satisfactory breast, a serviceable nipple. Seated on a low chair under the library window, this young mother endured the scrutiny of 3 women and a man, the doctor. Of the 2 babies, one slept, sated, but the other was furiously hungry.
"Uncover both, if you please, Mrs. McAdam," said the doctor loudly to the wet nurse, loudly enough to be heard above the angry baby boy squalling in the arms of Hopi, the nursery maid. Constantia McAdam opened her bodice to uncover both breasts. Dr. Moyer had already conducted his examination, already reported to Mrs. Chambers that there were no symptoms of syphilis or consumption, no sign in this young mother or her surviving baby of any dependence upon laudanum, no medical reason why Mrs. McAdam should not be able to nurse Mrs. Chambers' baby as well as her own. She claimed to have had plenty of milk for 2 during the first 5 weeks that both her twins had lived. He had watched her feed her surviving baby girl, now asleep in the arms of their friend, Mrs. MacDonald. It was evidently thriving, and the same age as Mrs. Chambers's hungry baby boy. The misfortune of the twins' death several days ago was due not to any communicable disease, nor to maternal malfeasance, but only to the divine will, inscrutable and mysterious, in the form, Dr. Moyer guessed privately, of a congenital kidney disorder. Though Hopi rocked and joggled and crooned to Mrs. Chambers' hungry baby, he would not be quiet. At a nod from the doctor, she transferred him, crimson-faced and raging, to Mrs. McAdam's arms. Mrs. McAdam handled this precious infant well, hands slow, quiet, firm. Clean, too. She took him into the crook of her right arm, fitted him across her body, his belly to her own. With her left hand, she lifted her right breast to his mouth. For a moment he quieted and eagerly nuzzled, grazing the nipple with his lips, but then craned away, his face crumpled. As he opened his mouth, drawing breath to squawk, Mrs. McAdam deftly filled his open mouth with her nipple, pressing against his toothless gums. His eyes flew open, and for a moment he seemed about to close and suck. But then he twisted away once more, arching backwards in her arms, furiously rejecting this unfamiliar nipple, this wrong-smelling breast. In his rage, he pulled one arm free of his wrappings to thrash the air.
Mrs. McAdam set thumb and forefinger on either side of her nipple and pressed. Her milk came, greyish and watery. She caught a droplet on her smallest fingertip and dabbled it onto his lips. Then again. His lips parted. His tiny tongue curled. Once more she offered milk on her fingertip, and this time he sucked it. Swiftly she put him to the nipple once more. He closed upon it, drew upon it, sucked. They could all hear him. In less than a minute, her milk let down. He coughed once, as the milk came too fast to swallow, then greedily resumed, and three fine sprays of milk arched from her other nipple, the one he was not suckling, soaked her linen.
"Plenty of milk for two," Dr. Moyer was saying.
Mrs. Chambers was smiling. Hopey was smiling. Mrs. MacDonald was smiling. But Constantia McAdam did not smile. She was transfixed by the sight of the baby's tiny splayed hand, clamped now like a small rosy starfish against her breast, a thumb, and five perfect fingers. Not four. Five. The commodious old house was called Spring Gardens. It lay in spacious, private grounds, outside Edinburgh, between Newhales and Musselburgh, just above the harbour and the cottages of Fisher Row, to the west of the River Esk. Here, the Robert Chambers family had spent the summer of 1845 as tenants, while their house in Doon Terrace in Edinburgh was undergoing repairs. Now, in September, though summer was past, the Doon Terrace repairs were not quite complete, and here at Spring Gardens, therefore, the family still remained. Besides the two infants, Charles Edward Chambers and Livia McAdam, eight other children were living in the house. The eldest, at 15, was Nina. Next was Mary, then Annie, named for her mother, and the twins, Jenny and Lizzie, both 9 and very pretty, but vacuous. Grave little Tucky was 7. Then came the two little boys, both still in frocks, James, called Jemmy, aged 4, and 2-year-old William, called Willie, much distressed at his recent ouster upon the birth of Charlie from the privileged position of baby. There seemed to be others, too, somewhere, for where were the Janet, Eliza, and Amelia sometimes mentioned? It was some days before Constantia McAdam understood that these were only the formal names of Jenny, Lizzie, and Tucky. Polly, it emerged, was a recently outgrown nickname of Mary's, sometimes still used by mistake or to annoy. There seemed to be a Rob or Robbie, too, heard of but never seen. He, however, turned out to be a 13-year-old schoolboy, his father's namesake, who had already returned to his school for the Michaelmas term. For the girls, the summer had been a long holiday from lessons. Their adored governess, Mamselle, had gone to France to visit her ailing mother, and was not expected to return before October. Until then, Hopey, the nursemaid, presided alone over most of the rooms on the top floor of the house. Day nursery, night nursery, big girls' rooms and little girls' rooms. Hopey had been with the Chambers family ever since coming as wet nurse to Lizzie and Jenny 9 years before. If she wished, she might have had another nursery maid under her for the summer, to help look after all these children, to bathe them, dress and undress them, induce them to eat their meals and get into and out of their beds at the proper times, take them out to run across the sands and play at the shore, teach them to say, "If you please, ma'am," and "Thank you, sir," and the game of checkers, and to adjudicate their near-constant quarrels, grudges, squabbles, contests, disputes, jealousies and bickerings. But Serene Hopey preferred to manage by herself until Mamselle should return. An untrained, homesick young nursery maid, said Hopey, would be muckle bother and small use, and hadn't the house lasses enough in it already? It was Hopey who had surprised the first wet nurse in the very act of administering Godfrey's cordial to the 5-week-old baby Charlie. Instantly that wet nurse had been sacked. But how, then, was the baby to be fed? Both cow's milk and mare's milk were tried. Both sickened him. Mrs. Chambers had sent express to every domestic agency in or near Edinburgh, to no avail. Were there no young mothers with milk to spare in all the Lothians? Well, of course there were. but if said young mother must also be of decent character and good repute, and unhabituated to gin or laudanum, and in robust health, without venereal or consumptive taint, and willing to come upon the instant to live in the chamber's household, and not already engaged to suckle some other woman's baby. Mrs. Chambers's unreasonable stipulations narrowed the field to none. It so happened that not even one such young matron could be found just then, at the critical moment of need. Mrs. Chambers attempted belatedly to establish her own milk, but at 5 weeks after her confinement it was far too late for that. All her friends told her it would be so. But one of these friends, Mrs. MacDonald, had another friend staying with her just then in Edinburgh, a young married woman called Mrs. MacAdam. She was a family connection of some years' standing, whose husband was necessarily at some distance just at present, and for obscure reasons, obscure to Mrs. Chambers at least, this young wife had deemed it best to come to the MacDonalds in Edinburgh for her first lying-in. It was just as well that she had, for there had been brought to bed of twins, a boy and a girl. Though Mrs. MacAdam's infant girl thrived, her boy languished, and at 34 days of age, on the same day as it happened that Mrs. Chambers was obliged to sack that first wicked wet-nurse, he died, having never pissed in all his brief life.
"Charlie is our darling, our darling, our darling. Charlie is our darling, our young chevalier."
Lizzie and Jenny would sing several times each day as they romped along the upstairs corridor to honour their newest baby brother. Indeed, all the children sang old Jacobite songs, "Will you no come back again?" or "Johnny Cope," or "Away Wigs Away," at the top of their lungs. They were a musical family, and they were practising for a gala occasion, the party to be given by their mother a few weeks hence. The general feeling among all these children was amicable enough, but with plenty of the warmth of friction. That warmth amounting, from time to time, to actual heatedness, followed by a natural cooling. Their alliances constantly shifted, and then reformed, like the polities of Europe, except for the twins, who were always to be found ranged upon the same side, in any contest or debate. In this houseful of merry children, Constantia MacAdam had to herself a small room with a bed, a carpet, a chair, a writing-table, and a window. It was separated from the day-nursery only by a thin wall of boards, so that at any time she might hear voices through the partition. What a talkative, playful, mirthful clan they were! They reminded Constantia of nothing so much as a litter of tumbling puppies, one scarcely distinguishable from the next, except for Nina, eldest, Tucky, gravest, the twins, and the little boys, unmistakably boyish, despite their frocks. Constantia's room smelled of milk both sweet and curdled, and sleep, and babies. Day and night, at intervals of an hour or two, rarely as long as 3 hours, Hopi would bring her an infant to be suckled, either Livia or Charlie. The babies were brought in, raging with hunger, but when they were taken away, 20 minutes later, they were soft and sweet with milk. Constantia felt the family enfold her, not as a servant, but as a cherished friend and guest. Whether en famille or in company, Mrs. Chambers always welcomed her in the drawing-room or dining-room, but so irregular were the baby's appetites, and so profoundly fatigued was Constantia, that Mrs. Chambers urged her to order her meals brought up to her room whenever she liked. The food was good, plain, abundant and nourishing. Mutton or beef, squab or chicken, mussel stew or fish, porridge, eggs, custards, bread and butter. There was generally ale or stout, too, for the sake of her milk. She had plenty of everything, except sleep. Constantia could not stray far from her room and the hungry babies, but each morning, and again each afternoon, she would take a turn in the garden below the house, whether it rained or shone. This being Scotland and September, it often rained. She would walk down to the dovecote, the dewcote the Scots called it, at the bottom of the garden, where the pigeons, looked after by the gardener, strutted and cooed, and bred as they pleased, and enjoyed the freedom of the sky. Her own pigeon was housed here too, in a small pen to itself, the sole pigeon which still remained to her of the 4 she had brought with her from the place where she had been before. It could not be allowed to fly free, lest it fly away home immediately. Just beyond the garden wall, to northward, she could smell the white-capped firth of Forth, and sometimes hear the waves. From the attic windows, the beautiful, busy water could be seen between trees, and on clear days, the far shore, Fife. It was an existence as placid, as dull, as a cow's. Her suffering was muffled here too, as though swaddled in layers of flannel. How curious! But her room was just above Mr. and Mrs. Chambers's rooms, it seemed. It was not a well-built house, and sometimes she could not help but hear them in what should have been their private moments. That was deeply disturbing. It raised the nap of her suffering again. The baby Charlie had not only an extra finger on each hand, but also an extra toe on each foot. All these supernumerary digits were well formed, and, unless one counted, this unusual abundance, this superfluity, this redundancy, this exuberance of digits, might go unnoticed. Constantia thought she could discern a puckered, reddened place on the plump outside edge of four-year-old Jemmy's right hand, just where an extra finger might have been removed by a surgeon. But there was no such mark on his left hand, nor on Willie's hands, nor on the hands of any of the girls.
"I told her this morning that you were expected, and she promised to come down if she can. And if she cannot, why, we will go up to her instead," said Mrs. Chambers to her friend Mary MacDonald, as they passed from the gusty garden into the bright, still orangery which opened off the drawing-room. "Ah, here is our tea laid ready for us. Is there a more agreeable sight on a blustery afternoon? I feared that my bonnet had been turned quite inside out," she added, untying it and laying it aside, undamaged. "Poor Mrs. MacAdam. Hope he does what she can to spare her. But I know she gets scant sleep. My young Chevalier does very well with her, and has greatly gained back the flesh he had lost and more, though he remains somewhat fractious still. It is the lingering effect of the laudanum he had from that wicked nurse, Dr. Moyer says. But that, he assures me, should go off quite soon." "You will forgive my seeing once more," called a woman's voice promptly from the adjoining drawing-room, "that entirely too much fuss has been made about laudanum." To her friend, Mrs. MacDonald, Mrs. Chambers raised one eyebrow very decidedly, while she called out, "Oh, Lady Janet, are you there? I did not know. Will you come and drink a cup of tea with Mrs. MacDonald and me?" Lady Janet, a guest who had been staying with the Chambers family for quite long enough, now appeared in the doorway. "You know that I speak plainly, Mrs. Chambers," said she, an elderly woman whose cap was of a pattern which had not been seen for 10 years. The cairngorm brooch which fastened her pelerin was, though large, of regrettable shape and colour. "I have used Godfrey's cordial myself from time to time," she said, "and it has never done me anything but good. Anyone of good character, of a strongly formed and well-regulated character, may take it without danger. I must say again, Mrs. Chambers, it is no pleasure for me to say it, but it is my duty, that you ought not to have sacked that first nurse. You were wrong to act in such haste. I make it a principle, you know, to speak plainly. Your family was certainly better off with that modest and sensible nurse in the house than this mysterious hussy, with her French clothes and the face and figure of an actress, a French actress, or worse." Said Mrs. Chambers, "Your ladyship knows more than I of physiognomy, it would seem, for I had supposed that a person's distinguishing qualities are evidenced by her conduct, not by her face, figure, or dress. I am quite prepared to admit that I have been wrong. No one could pretend that Mrs. MacAdam is not exceedingly lovely. The soft-speaking eyes, the golden hair, the sweet dimple to her chin. But if these are the infallible signs of base propensities, I can only plead that I have never heard it before." "Oh, but to go by a false name," said Lady Janet, "if it is by conduct that we are to judge, why, there surely is indefensible conduct. to style herself Mrs. McAdam? Has she never yet told you her husband's true name?"
"No, my lady, and I shan't press her," said Mrs. Chambers serenely, as she poured out the tea. "This, it seems, must be one of those matters on which we think differently, you and I. You remember my friend, Mrs. MacDonald, by whose kind agency Mrs. McAdam came to us in our time of need?"
"I trust I see you well, Mrs. MacDonald," said Lady Janet, "and I hope that you do not suffer as I do from these September gales. I do not suppose that you have knowingly brought any wicked person to lodge in our midst, but can you feel quite certain that Mrs. MacAdam is in truth an honest married woman?"
"She is as honest a married woman as I am," declared Mrs. MacDonald stoutly.
"You will have seen that she wears a ring," said Mrs. Chambers, with a glance at her own wedding ring. Her fingers were ink-smudged, for she had spent the morning, as usual, at her writing-table in the library.
"Anyone may be clever enough to provide herself with a ring," said Lady Janet, "but to go by a false name—"
"Perhaps we might refer to it as an assumed name, a pseudonym," said Mrs. Chambers, "which I fancy has a more respectable sound. She makes it no secret that MacAdam is a name assumed out of discretion for her husband's sake, a discretion which is required of her for reasons which she is not at liberty to divulge."
"A complete stranger, of whom nothing is known."
"But she is by no means a stranger, Lady Janet," said Mrs. MacDonald. "I have known her for years. She was Miss Constantia Babcock when I first met her 4 or 5 years ago, a well-brought-up girl of 18 or so. My husband knew her mother and father aboard ship, years ago, when they all sailed out to India together. And my niece vouches for her too, for they were little girls together in India. I have met her stepmother as well. The Rani who brought her up in the Indies, after her parents both had died. A remarkable personage, and a sterner and more virtuous matron never lived."
"But to conceal her name," said Lady Janet.
"Although we are not at present to know her husband's true name," said Mrs. MacDonald patiently, "there is not the slightest ground for suspecting folly or vice. I should never have dreamt of bringing her along to Mrs. Chambers else."
"And folk may have perfectly innocent reasons for preserving a discreet anonymity," added Mrs. Chambers. "No one can charge her with guile or deceit, only with a quite determined reticence on this particular subject, for which she may, indeed most, have excellent reasons of her own. Now, my dears, if you like my gingerbread at all, you had better have it at once, before the children come in. They will be famished, for they have been upon the sands all the afternoon, with only a very large picnic hamper bursting with refreshments to sustain them. I fancy I hear them now." This was by no means one of those tranquil households where children are seen and not heard. The children came in hungry, wind-blown, and red-nosed, bearing trophies of shell, rock, and seaweed to add to the collections already decorating the chimney-piece and the window-sills. While the presence of children at downstairs tea was another of those matters on which Lady Janet disagreed with her hostess, and often found it her duty to say so, her conscience permitted her on this occasion to keep her own counsel. Instantly the remaining gingerbread disappeared. The Chambers children were accompanied by friends, including one Emily de Quincey, just Mary's age, who lived nearby and had come for the day to play. Emily was the youngest daughter of the notorious English opium-eater. She was a well-behaved and musical child who, brought up by her respectable elder sisters and not her disreputable and impecunious father, was thought to be a suitable companion for Mary. She and her sisters were often at Spring Gardens. Fortunately, Lady Janet had no more to say at present on the subject of laudanum. Nina, the eldest of the Chambers girls, came in at last. She had not been on the sands with the little children. Instead, she had remained upstairs by herself to draw and to read, in luxurious solitude and rare quiet. Even now she carried her book downstairs with her finger marking her place in it. "Is not Mrs. MacAdam coming down for tea?" someone asked. "I keeked in as I passed the door," said Nina, "and she has just got both babies fed, and asleep for a miracle. She'll be down in a moment." Presently, Constantia did come in, thirsty and too warm. Mrs. MacDonald rose to kiss her, and Mrs. Chambers gave her tea. To make room for her on the sofa, Nina retired to a chair under the window, where she resumed reading, while the others chatted happily.
"What is your book, Miss Nina?"
called Lady Janet after some time.
"Vestiges," replied Nina reluctantly, looking up. "Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation."
"Good heaven!" said Lady Janet. "Something about that red binding aroused my suspicion. Does your mother know? Were you aware, Mrs. Chambers, that Miss Nina has somehow got hold of that pernicious book, The Vestiges?"
"Pernicious?" said Mrs. Chambers. "No, whatever that book may be, Lady Janet, I'm sure it is not pernicious."
"Pernicious, and sensational, and wicked, and blasphemous," said Lady Janet. "I am surprised, indeed grieved, at your permitting the entry of such a book as that into this house full of innocent children."
"Oh, I cannot tell what good mothers may permit, Lady Janet, but I for my part am confident that Nina may read it, if she likes, without coming to any positive harm."
"I beg your pardon," said Lady Janet, offended, and then, "you will, I hope, excuse me leaving you and the children to yourselves for a time. Others do not suffer as I do from noise."
She gathered up her skirts and stalked out. An embarrassed silence ensued. Then Tucky said, "Mamma, how long is she staying with us?"
"She won't be at our day of treason, will she?" said Lizzie.
"No, hinny, we shall have to manage without her that day," said Mrs. Chambers, "for she has told me that she is engaged elsewhere."
"Day of treason!" cried Mrs. MacDonald, delighted. "Is that what you were calling your party?"
Mrs. Chambers had invited all her lively and clever friends to a gala day, the centennial of Bonnie Prince Charlie's first and last great victory, the Battle at Prestonpans of 1745. The actual anniversary was the 21st of September, which, in this centennial year of 1845, fell unfortunately upon a Sunday. As it was impossible to celebrate such an event on the Sabbath, Mrs. Chambers had determined instead upon Saturday the 20th as her day for celebration and memorial of that great Jacobite victory. The invitations had all been sent, and now the acceptances and regrets were flooding in, swelling each day's mail.
"I do hope that the princes are coming," said Jenny fervently.
She was often a beneficiary of the sweets brought by her father's old friends, those handsome, clever, good-natured frauds, the Sobieski Stuarts, otherwise the Allen brothers, whenever they paid a visit.
"Are they?"
"Alas, they cannot, though," said Mrs. Chambers. "I had a note this morning from the equerry, posted from London, where there is some important business afoot, a very deep secret. It is a relief in some respects, a release from the grave responsibility of furnishing an adequate pomp for their middling highnesses. But we shan't have the benefit of their piper, more's the pity. I shall have to hunt up another for the occasion, and time is getting short."
"Oh, but I can bring you a piper," said Mrs. MacDonald. "His name is Dr. John Singh. But there, I am forgetting that Mrs. MacAdam knows him very well, don't you, my dear?"
"From childhood we have been as cousins, I suppose, if not quite brother and sister," said Constantia.
"He has just taken his medical degree at Glasgow," explained Mrs. MacDonald to Mrs. Chambers, "and is now preparing to return to the wilds of Assam, where he was born, to commence his practice among the people there. And though you might not expect it to look at him, for he is quite as black as that celebrated Mr. Frederick Douglass from America, he is as accomplished a piper as he is anatomist, or so I am told by my husband, who is well qualified to pronounce. Pronounce as to his piping, I mean, not his anatomizing."
"I shall be very happy," said Mrs. Chambers, "to receive an accomplished piper anatomist at my gala day, of any colour whatever. How fortunate I am in my friends, whose circle of acquaintance always seems to include precisely those talents they want. First milk, and now pipe music."
What was that book in which Nina's finger kept her place? That book in its modest red cloth binding? That Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation? Brought out by a London medical publisher the previous December, it had by now, 9 months later, sold out 4 large editions.
the publishing sensation of the decade. Though ignored by the science...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?